Let me call us to order. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this rather oddly named session, Iraq Sustaining America's Support. But I think it's appropriately named because this is certainly the issue of the day in Washington, and it's a particular pleasure to have somebody as qualified to address it as Dr. Muwaffaq al-Rubai, who I think I first met him actually on National Public Radio. He has been a very effective communicator for Iraq for a long time now. We did actually meet, I believe, in 2004 in Baghdad. I've been a great admirer of his capacity to communicate with Americans and to convey a very clear idea of what he thinks is happening in Iraq. And that's particularly important at this moment. America is seized with a discussion of Iraq policy that has very far-reaching implications, not only for Iraq, but also for the region. And so without further ado, let me ask Dr. Rubai to take the floor. We will take questions after his remarks.
I won't leave any time for questions, I can tell you. That's the trick. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. There are so many familiar faces here, friends and people who have worked really for Iraq. And I have to mention Stephen Sollars, is a great friend of Iraq and a great American. Thank you very much for having me here. Distinguished friends of the U.S. U.S. Institute for Peace, I'm honored to be with you this afternoon to share with you some of my perspective and from Iraq. I'm going to state some of the facts the way we see it. We feel that we are in the middle of a titanic struggle, which will determine not our the fate of our democracy, but also the very character of the whole region. Our constitutional government is not quite 1 year old, and it's already the demand from our own citizens and the whole world, and from some friend in this part of the world trying to state or impose some benchmark on us. At this crucial time in our history, I want to outline for you where we are and where we are going. Where we are going to go through a very short summary of the progress we made. There are three areas in which I would like to update you on the progress and our challenges. I'll start with the status of transition of security responsibility from the coalition to the provincial governments. And this is particularly vital measure of success because it's based on actual condition on the ground and on the ability of the provincial government and police to obtain security. And this is joint assessment of the coalition and the Iraqi government. Second is the Baghdad security plan. We and the coalition acknowledge that there must be a success in Baghdad for there to be a success nationwide. Our capital, as we've said several times, is our center of gravity. And I'm going to touch upon very quickly as well on the third topics, which I want to give you a broad overview of our success in building our security forces. Because people, some people, I find in the Hill and otherwise, they think that we are sitting doing absolutely nothing. What I want to do is to give you an idea of how far we have come since we have started from zero about 3 years ago. If you go back 3 years ago, when Jerry Bremer handed over the sovereignty to Dr. Alawi, I was there, and he turned around to me and said, Dr. Wei, after Jerry Bremer left with his, he took off, he said, well, what is it, how much the, what is the size of the army? I said, one battalion, 500 soldiers. That's June 2004. Now, I'll go through the details later, so that nobody will think that we were doing nothing, sitting in Baghdad enjoying ourselves. I didn't know what to do. Let me start with the status of transition of the security responsibility to the provincial control. 7 out of 18 provinces have met the condition for taking over their own secure responsibility. The three provinces in the Kurdistan is going to transfer or transition the responsibility before the end of this month. So our approach is to province by province, to proceed province by province, identifying obstacles to security transition, resolving these obstacles, and passing control to provincial authorities when all parties, Iraqis and coalition, are convinced that the condition for the transition has been met. And the last one was Maysan. These conditions, as you know, the local government has to be legitimate and effective. The threat to the provincial security are low and manageable by the local police. And if they, and the third one, if they get overwhelmed by any threat, by the militia or by insurgents or terrorists, then the multinational forces are over the horizon to help them. And this is a tangible progress. We aim to accelerate this progress, transitioning all the 18 provinces before the end of 2007. Now let's turn to Baghdad security plan. To be fair, we have always recognized the importance of Baghdad in our struggle against terrorists and insurgents. Previous plans, we're disappointed with the results. But we learned a lot of lessons from previous plans. We analyzed the plan, the previous plans, and applied lessons learned in designing the current plan. I want to stress the main lessons we have learned and applied on this plan. We learned from the previous plan and we are applying it on this plan. We learned that the unity yields better results than independent operations. Therefore, we integrated Iraqi police, Iraqi army, and the multinational forces into teams in all over Baghdad, and we divided Baghdad into 10 districts. And each district has its joint security stations. This has improved greatly Iraqi forces capabilities and produced more effective results. If you're interested in the result, I can tell you later. We also learned a lesson that one cannot defeat this threat of insurgency and terrorism with military action alone. It takes the integration of all military, economics, and politics. We also learned that the forces and services must stay hand in hand in neighborhoods to ensure the job is done. There are four areas, distinct areas, I can tell you we made a huge progress on. Reducing murders, improving local commerce, limiting sectarian violence, and improving sanitation. in some of these troubled areas. We are also making significant progress in building the broad governmental capabilities needed for self-reliance. Last year, we set up 9 committees to guide these efforts. Perhaps this is a record, world record, for multitasking at the top government level. And these committees, I'll name some of them, train and equip the MOD forces, the Ministry of Defense Forces, train and equip Ministry of Interior Forces, transfer control of Army Forces to the Ministry of Defense, transition to the Iraqi Provincial Security Control, develop ministerial capability, develop an Iraqi counterterrorism capability, establish an appropriate national security architecture, develop national intelligence system, and so on and so forth. So we're building a new state from scratch. In 2003, what happened is wasn't a coup d'etat to remove the top layer. The whole state collapsed on us, because the state was built upside down. In building our security forces, we must be setting a world record. And I can give you an example. I told you that in 2004, June, we had 1 battalion. Now we have 11 divisions, 150,000+ soldier on the ground, different specialties, if you like, and more than 250,000 employees in the Ministry of Interior. I think 15 brigades of the National Police. They were all built in the last 3 years. Building army is not a joke. Building a professional army is not a job. Building the Saddam Hussein army, yes, that's easy. In building our security forces, as I mentioned, it's not something easy. I think that we must have the world record. And the main points I would like you to look at and concentrate on are the magnitude of our success in the last three years. Let me emphasize some main elements of in our overall approach in building our Iraqi security forces. First, we concentrated on the forces essential to defeat terrorism and terrorists and insurgents. And you can see how far we got into developing our MOI and MOD forces. Second, we built a very modest capability in our Air Force and Navy. It's a modest one, but it's a start. But this building Air Force and Navy, we're not talking about months, we're talking about not even years, sometimes decades, to build a tangible Air Force to deter aggression from across the borders. And we don't have a very friendly neighbors, remember that. I would like to turn quickly to our approach to the future and begin with our effort for national reconciliation. Perhaps the national reconciliation is the central core issue that will define the future of Iraq. If we are not able to reconcile our differences, we risk disintegration and endless conflict. For many of us, this is the highest priority of our national leaders. Without reconciliation, we can have no unity in Iraq. Reconciliation is not primarily about forgiveness for past misconduct. Reconciliation is about putting the past in the past and shaping a new and better future for all Iraqis. Reconciliation calls for honoring those who have suffered from conflict and welcoming back all who are willing to return and come back to the national fold. This is perhaps the main task in our struggle, engaging all elements of our society, hopefully with the support of international community. I would like to turn quickly to the new national security strategy we are drafting and we are producing, hopefully, and don't take this as a benchmark, by the 14th of July, it will see the light. This new Iraq national security strategy will confirm our national vision, the kind of country we aim to be. It will also define our national interests and objectives for the present and into the future. It will explain how we aim to harness all our resources, government, economic, military, informational, and so on and so forth, and apply them deliberately to attain our objectives. Three catchphrases here: security, prosperity, and self-reliance. Defeat threats and reconcile our society. These are the central strategy in our new national security strategy. Defeat threats and reconcile our society. Put our vast resources to work for all Iraqis and become friendly and collaborative neighbor and positive influence in the international community. The third element guiding our strategic thinking about the future in the international compact. That's the international compact. I'm sure you heard about it. It's vital to our future because it addresses the major needs for our future prosperity beyond security. It gives the future vision of Iraq in politics, in security, and mainly in economy. So it talks about something other than security. The compact will assist us in engaging international donors and investors, governmental, non-governmental, and private sector organizations in promoting our development. I'm pleased. I just came back from a meeting with the Secretary General. He has appointed, as you know, everybody knows, that he has appointed one of the most senior United Nations officials, Dr. Ibrahim Gambari, to be his special representative and guide this effort of international compact. And a week ago, as you know, it was approved, this document, this very important document, in Sharm el Sheikh conference. And there was a huge attendance, 60 plus country foreign ministers and so on and so forth, from all over the world, basically supporting Iraq. It's our best hope for facilitating the compact to facilitate global support for Iraq from areas other than the security. The final element in our strategic thinking about the future is the regional engagement. By this I mean collaborative effort with Iraq as a full participant to help security in the region. Not only the region, but the rest of the world. Collaborative effort to build mutual confidence would attenuate conflict and establish mutually beneficial security arrangement and offers a path to peaceful and prosperous future. And Iraq is actively sounding its neighbors for a collaborative bilateral and multilateral arrangement, security arrangement, and other integration. And the neighbors conference last week, which followed the compact in Sharm el Sheikh, I think it was very, very successful one. So the regional engagement is a major individual activity. It will be an integral element of our new national security strategy. strategy. My final point, before I allow you to shoot me with some questions. Let me summarize. I have shared with you some of the elements we in the Iraqi government believe are most important to understanding the progress we have made to date and challenges we face. I've outlined for you the four major areas on which we are concentrating our strategic thinking in shaping secure, peaceful, prosperous, and self-reliant Iraq in the future. I'll share this with you. Ours is an old civilization. We are now experiencing a rebirth of that civilization. I would like to think that we have a very competent midwife. And the midwife should not pull the rug from underneath us at the last mile we are walking. I can see the success, I can feel the success, and I believe the U.S. support is pivotal for the success of our for the region of Iraq and the region. With all honesty, all Iraqis are very appreciative. The enormous and unselfless and unselfish contribution of the U.S. in this most noble of efforts. I thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you very much. We can let you sit down.
I think more in control.
Good. Okay. I'm going to ask people to line up to ask questions at the microphones. I'm going to abuse my privileges by asking a first one. When we were working on the Iraq Study Group report last December, the question of benchmarks came up. And there are benchmarks published in the Iraq Study Group report, which came from Prime Minister Maliki, and it says that there. There are also benchmarks in the recently approved Iraq Compact. They are exactly the same benchmarks. De-ba'athification law, oil law, provincial elections law. The only difference is that the deadlines have slipped 6 to 9 months. Can you give us some confidence that this new deadline, basically the end of 2007, that it will be met on important matters?
Let me say something before I answer the question. This is a very important question. Benchmark doesn't translate very well to Arabic. And honestly, I'm serious. And also, benchmark, as you understand it, is a very alien word in our culture. Okay? But that's not on the record, is it? Timeline, benchmark, ultimatums, whatever you call it. We in the Iraqi government or the Policy Council for National Security has made objectives we would like to achieve in the next year or so, or in the next 6 months or so. So there are objectives. We will work towards getting there. But if we don't get by the 12 o'clock midnight of that date, that is total failure and it's a disaster and you're useless and that doesn't work like this. There are three clocks. There are not two clocks. 1 o'clock is extremely fast. Works with that's in D.C., okay, in Washington. The other clock, which is I call it natural clock. Because it needs the natural evolution, natural growth of things. Otherwise, if you ram it down our throat, it will create a reaction. And the second, this is the natural clock in Baghdad. There is another clock in the region, which it works in reverse. It doesn't work like this. It works different like this, because it wants to impede the wheel. I think it is the time now to sync the three clocks, to Baghdad clock, to Baghdad time. What happened, people think that what happened in Baghdad was a coup d'etat overnight, I don't know, General Qasim overthrew the monarchy and established a republic. Or Saddam overthrew whatever, Abdusalam Arif and this is not, that is not what happened in Baghdad. In Iraq in 2003, huge, I call it paradigm shift, from the old ossified, calcified regime, set of rules and order of dictatorship, religious supremacy, to a new, completely new set of rules. Human rights, democracy, freedom. This is alien in that part of the world. And you want to establish this in 3 years' time or in 4 years' time? To establish a new culture. This paradigm shift, what I keep on saying, needs a strategic patience. And you cannot fit this paradigm shift, which needs years to get established properly, in the election cycle of DC. You can't fit it up. It doesn't fit in a slot. So you need to think, people need to think in a different mode, in a different clock, and think that this is a strategic objective we need to attain and we need to get to. Otherwise, you can't have a baby in 2, 3, 4 months' time. Otherwise, it will be premature, it will be disformed, it will be all sorts of things. You need a proper 9 months for a baby to get born properly. I'm using a lot of my medical background, probably.
Reminds me that.
Mr. Sarad hasn't answered your question. We are determined in the Iraqi government to work on these 5 or 6 issues. These 6 issues, I'll tell you, we'll come back in September, or David Petraeus and Ryan Tracker will come back in September and said, the budget has been spent. I think this is one benchmark, good benchmark. We have approved and ratified by the Council of Representatives the hydrocarbon laws. It's only dotting the I's and crossing the T's. There's nothing in the hydrocarbon law to be. It's already there. We're 99.99% recurring done, probably. These are definitely, we're coming back with solid achievement, if you like. Others, de-ratification. You want us to? You want me to compare? Put the hat from the south, from Kurdistan as well. Either hat I'll put. You want to discuss renazification of Germany? That's some people, some communities in that part of the world feel about discussing any or reviewing anything in the ratification. So what do we need? We need time to desensitize and educate our people that no, this is not all about re-ratification. It's all about people who have, for one reason or another, they got into Arab Ba'ath Socialist Party, and now we're bringing them back and make it a judicial process rather than a political settling score process. The provincial election law. We will be in an advanced stage of discussing, a serious discussion. And de-ratification, the President and the Prime Minister have signed a draft bill to the Council of Representatives, which is called Accountability and Justice, to replace de-ratification. accountability for those who have committed the crimes and justice for those who are the victims of these crimes. So my point is this: it has to be a natural evolution of this process, and it has to take its time and space. You can't sort of fit this process, which is a strategic, historic changes in Iran, in a very short time, because, and we understand the need of our friends here. We sympathize with it. We try to help. We have no problem with that. Absolutely no problem. But things have to be understood in a better way. What the fight up there is a strategic fight. It's not the war is there. It's not about Iraq. The war there, we are leading. We're at the central front of the war, global war, against this Al Qaeda. Is not months. It's going to be years, and we have to look at it like this. And Iraq is at the forefront. So
I mentioned it, Dr. Rubayi, earlier that it appears, as somebody has said, I'm not sure who gets credit for this, but that the Americans have all the clocks and the Iraqis have all the time. But I'm going to take two at a time here. Please introduce yourself. Quick question, and you'll be ready to.
Rabbi, thank you for coming. Ayad Marjan from the National Endowment for Democracy. You mentioned there's a new security strategy plan that would be put in place sometime in July that would provide the security, prosperity, and self-reliance. Do you think that, hypothetically speaking, if the United States were to withdraw their forces by, say, end of 2007, can Iraq... the new strategy plan, can that strategy plan provide that self-reliance? Can it provide that security to the people? Can it fill in that power vacuum? If not, by then, when do you think it would be possible for that security plan to come into play and fill in that power vacuum? Thank you.
Please.
Rafaeli from Middle East Media Research Institute. My question deals with the Iraqi external debt. The Paris Club has recommended that the debtor countries cancel 80% of the Iraqi outstanding debts. So far, only the industrialized countries have done so. Were you surprised or disappointed that at the conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Saudi Arabia has given only a qualified commitment to cancel the debt, Kuwait said nothing, and Russia linked any reduction of debt with rights of exploration at the Rumaila oil field? Thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm not clear. What's the question?
The question is, are you disappointed that Kuwait, for example, has made no commitment to reduce the debt, and it's one of the major debtor countries to Iraq, and that Saudi Arabia gave only a qualified...
Thank you. Let me start answering this, because this is... I can avoid answering it directly, so it's easy for me. we're very happy that the Saudis has come up with the in Sharm el-Sheikh and mentioned again the $1 billion they have donated to Iraq in Madrid a couple of years ago, and as well as they came up with the. Paris Club discount of reduction of the debt for forgiveness of 80%, I believe. With Kuwait, it's much more complicated than this. There are more than two, but mainly two. One is the debts, and the other one is the war reparation. And we have decided in the Iraqi government, you know, this is the first Iraqi government. This government has started just a year ago, less than a year ago, to go into and get engaged with the Kuwaitis on the war reparation. Debt forgiveness, I think it's easier, because there is a term of reference, which is the Paris Club, but the war reparation is much more difficult. I'm leaving. As soon as I leave this hall, I will go and see the Secretary of Treasury and discuss this very point, that we need an alternative. One of the ideas we are tossing around is to establish a Kuwaiti fund for Iraq reconstruction, and we put the money for war reparation in this, and then they will control it still. The Kuwaitis will continue controlling it, but it's reconstructing Iraq. That's one of the ideas we're trying to sell our Kuwaiti. But Kuwaitis have to understand, and they do understand, they're a friendly government. They do understand that there is the security and stability of Iraq and democracy in Iraq is the only way forward for their national security. Otherwise, anything else is a problem for Kuwait.
Thank you.
The withdrawal, any precipitous withdrawal from Iraq will create a chaos, absolute chaos. There's no doubt about it. Phased withdrawal, yes. I will call it. I wouldn't call it redeployment. I would call it repositioning. There is a lot of ideas being discussed in the inner circle, but we're not in a hurry. I think we have not seen the fruits of Baghdad security plan and the upsurge. A few months to go, and I think it will be very clear what we are going to do next. I have seen so many people, and I told Mr. Sada, I came up with a lot of bruises, but they are internal bruises. You can't see from the hill. When I saw some people in the hill, they are really, really, well, heavyweights, but they were heavy on us as well, brutally heavy. We used to torturing, but a different type of torturing. We used to physical torturing by Saddam. Here it was different torturing. I honestly believe that we have managed to change some people's mind. Some big player. People have what I call T-walled themselves, put a concrete wall around themselves, because of the public opinion, because of their constituents, and they put that, I want you to withdraw, I want you to timeline, I want you this, I want you to ultimatum on the Iraqi government, and I want that. I think if you, in all honesty, and these all of them are well intentioned, if you explain to them the reality on the ground, what is going on in on the ground, I think they understand and they sympathize and they modified. I've seen it; they have modified their position, a couple of them. So I think the visit has already paid off.
Let's take two more, Alex.
Hi, Dr. Rui. I'm Alex Thier from the U.S. Institute of Peace. It's a pleasure to have you here. The USIP has been supporting the Constitutional Review Committee of the Council on Representatives and their attempts to come up with new amendments for the Constitution. And in doing so, one issue repeatedly comes up, which I think is a very important issue, which both holds potential for some solutions in the internal political dynamics of Iraq, but also great danger, and that is the issue of regionalization. The question that keeps coming up, because it's so unclear from the 2005 Constitution, is what is the relationship between the central government and eventual regions that may be formed? Obviously, there is a region of Kurdistan that's recognized. The other regions have yet to be formed or recognized, but there is clearly a move on, a momentum in the next year to form some of those regions. On one hand, you could see this tendency as a positive thing, as the communities of Iraq form themselves in such a way so that they'll be federal entities and they can relate to each other in a positive way and agree on a future social compact for the country. But there's also great danger, because many of these regions are very unclear about their borders and the constituent populations. And a rush or a push towards regionalization, in my opinion, holds a very great danger that there, once that this is set in motion, that there will be a move on all sides to redraw lines, which to my mind would expand the potential for conflict extraordinarily in the coming year as people start to realize that there are actual pieces of land and oil at stake. And this is something that we've seen in other contexts as well. And so I want you to comment on it because it really does hold the potential of promise but also great peril. And I'm wondering how you
Alex, you are against benchmarks now.
Well,
on regionalism and federalism.
I don't think it's the Americans who are setting the regionalization benchmarks.
No, well, I think it's very well said. Honestly, I like the way you put it. Sorry.
Let's take another one at the same time.
Peter Jewell from the Center for American Progress. There was a report in the AP today, I think it was, that 144 Iraqi parliament members voted to, you know, oppose the foreign presence in Iraq. I was wondering, one, if that's an accurate...
144?
Yeah. I was wondering, one, if that's accurate, and two, I mean, what does that mean? Because it seems like it would cut across lots of party lines.
No. I think this is from the internet, is it?
I'm
not aware of any... proposal which was tabled to the Council of Representatives of Foreign Troops withdrawal. I'm not aware of, and I'm not aware of any serious attempt, to be quite honest with you, to do this. And I'll be very surprised to hear that in this time. But if I can go back to Alex, the problem is the administrative borders of the provinces. This is a huge problem. In Kirkuk, in Ramadi used to be a tiny little province, now it is one third of Iraq, size-wise, area-wise. So if the administrative borders, you are absolutely right, it's a huge problem, and we need to address it. But it has to come in a natural way. And through engagement and through political political process, not imposing. For example, I'll take a probably contentious issue, and the doctor will understand better, is the Kirkuk issue. Kirkuk, we have a constitutional duty to hold a referendum and an election before the end of the year. People are penciling in 15th of November. To get there are so many, we need to fulfill a lot of technical requirements and political requirements to get there. So we need to start a political process to get there to the 15th, to the election. If we parachute election in Kirkuk like this, it will not be a solution, it will be a problem. It will exacerbate the problem if we just parachute it like this. So we need to have political engagement, political dialogue, technical requirement. What are the requirements? What is the ID of the people, and who's to be counted in the election? All sorts of things. We need to sort out some problem to get to the 15th of November or before the end of the year election. So these are, let me give you one, my idea, because I strongly believe in it, on regionalism. I'm a federalist and a strong federalist. I know some people here they have worked against federalism and invested a long time of their life against federalism. But let me say something. I believe part of reducing the violence in the western provinces is to encourage forming a region in the three western provinces. Yes. If we have a region like Kurdistan in the western provinces, the three western provinces, it will play a major part in reducing the violence. Because people are competing for political position. If there is a prime minister in, for example, let me imagine a capital of the region now the capital of the of Kurdistan is Erbil. The capital of the region of western region of the three provinces, Tikrit, for example. There will be a prime minister, there will be ministers, there will be a council of representatives, there will be elections, and there will be budget going that way. And they can sort themselves, instead of looking and competing and fighting and blowing up people to displace them from the center, the national leaders, they can do that, but not the blowing up. But the local leaders, those who wanted to be a governor, wanted to be a prime minister of the western region, they wanted to be a minister in the western region, or a president of the western region, I have no problem with that. I think it will create an opportunity for the local people to play or to compete for a political position. So I personally believe that after the provincial election, we should immediately start encouraging local people in the western provinces to have their own region. The south is a different issue. It's a completely different category. It's different.
Let me take all three of the last questioners and ask them to be brief, because I think we're running against time problems. Stanley?
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. How do you assess Iranian intentions? In particular, are you concerned about the possibility of an American-Iranian confrontation?
Hello, Dr. Mafak. Welcome. Marhaba. Actually, you touched upon my question was about Kirkuk.
You have to introduce yourself even to this audience.
Of course. I'm sorry. Nazmuddin Karim, Washington Kurdish Institute. You touched upon the issue of Kirkuk. By the way, I agree with you fully about federalism, and that's the only way to bring quiet and peace, particularly into the Sunni areas. And we can see how everybody's talking about how the tribal leaders are fighting Al-Qaeda. Unless they take ownership of the region, I think the chaos will continue. As far as Kirkuk, as you know, it's a very hot issue. There is interference when it comes to Kirkuk from neighboring countries, particularly Turkey, with different threats. I like to see what the position of official position of Iraqi government is regarding the threat when it comes to Kirkuk, which I believe is an Iraqi city. Whether it's going to be part of Kurdistan region or not, that's not going to change that fact. And second, the time is approaching for eventual referendum on Kirkuk, and we're only a few months away, and I like to see where we stand on that, since I just came back. I saw you in Baghdad. The president of President Talabani, President Barzani, they're all expecting for that to happen at the end of this year. And thank you and welcome.
Hello, Alan Brown from the Canadian Embassy. Just a quick question about what has happened at the Neighbors Conference in terms of moving forward with the three working groups that were decided upon at the Baghdad Neighbors meeting, the ones on energy, borders, and refugees. Thanks.
Thank you. We're going to torture you one more time because your good friend Steve Solars is going to ask a question.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems I'm the cleanup hitter, but it's good to see you again, Mofak. You indicated in your opening remarks that there really was no military solution to the conflict in Iraq. It would require a political settlement. Now, most civil wars, as you know, are resolved on the battlefield. One side prevails over the other. But there have been several examples where civil wars have been resolved through political settlements. And when I look at the recent examples of that in places like El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, South Africa, Northern Ireland, you find that in every one of those situations, essentially what you had was the government on one side and a relatively cohesive resistance group on the other, with a political leadership that could generally control the men under arms. So you had a negotiation where if an agreement was reached, it could be imposed on the combatants. In the case of Iraq, I have the impression you have a plethora, a multitude of resistance factions, ex-Ba'athists, secular nationalists, foreign jihadis, indigenous jihadis, criminal gangs, different militias, and so on. So my question is, in the effort to achieve a political settlement, with whom do you negotiate, and how do you actually expect to achieve a political settlement that can lead to a dramatic reduction, if not a complete elimination of the violence?
Thank you very much. This is the most difficult Ooh. One, Steve. I thought we were friends. Thank you. On Turkey, Dr. Necmettin, I think Turkey is a neighboring country. They're a friendly country with us, with Iraq. They are helping in some commerce and economy, and getting over some problems with us. But we in the central government, and I'm sure the KRG as well, we have decided to close any offices of the PKK all over the country, and we are reassured our Turkish neighbors that this is the way forward, and we will not allow any PKK bases in Iraq whatsoever. See, Richard Murphy as well. Hello. I'm sorry. My eyesight is here, and neurons as well going, fading away. Good to see you, sir. So that's on Turkey, Doctor. And on Kirkuk, I think I said what I needed to say. What happened in the neighboring country, I think it was a breakthrough. And on the southern fronts, number one, as the breakthrough with the meeting between the USG and Iranian government, between the US government and Iranian government, and it was not insignificant meeting, and they have agreed to do something after that, and I know that there's something planned very, very soon to happen. What we have said and what we are saying to the administration here is that we, the Iraqi government, need to be present in that meeting if you are planning to discuss Iraq. If you want to discuss any other issue, that's your prerogative. But if you discuss Iraq, we need to be present because this is our sovereignty. This is number one. And I think also there was a very good meeting between the Secretary of State and Al-Muallim, the foreign minister of Syria, and they discussed, and the Syrians know exactly what they need to do. There are no two ways about it. Foreign fighters, foreign jihadists coming from the different capital of our Arab brothers, they land in Damascus, and they vanished after that. They disappeared. And they ended up in Mosul or in Baghdad, killing themselves and killing our civilians. That's a very oversimplified description of the problem. But they know exactly what to do to stop this flow. And if they stop it, I can assure you that considerable reduction in the carbon will probably 60 or 70% will go away. So this is number one. And also number two is they have to stop the logistical support in the way of bases, training, and intelligence. And they know what to do. So they cannot. But I believe the American need to use not only the stick. They have to have some carrot for these people. And I think the administration is ready for that serious engagement. We're not interested in the show business. might serve some purpose in Sharm el-Sheikh, some media events. But I think Iran is serious about entering into dialogue with the United States government now. On the counterinsurgency strategy, some people agree with you, Steve, that until and unless you have a crashing defeat on one side and crashing victory on another side and breaking the will to fight back, you will not have a settlement. Some people believe that. It's a very considerate opinion. Political inclusion, who do you include politically? There are, as you said, a plethora of insurgent and terrorists. But I think we in our mind at least, and on the ground, we differentiate between two groups. One we call the insurgents, al-mutamarridin. And these are former regime elements, ex-Ba'athists, hardcore Saddamist, if you like, Saddam loyalist. Some of them, they are disfranchised, disenchanted. People have been felt marginalized, and these people are. We think that they are reconcilable. These people, but Al Qaeda and its affiliates, the foreign jihadists, these are irreconcilables. There is no political solution for this. For these people, they either kill us or we kill them. And it's not a secret that we are in a negotiation with the four, and now it's fifth group, serious group, of these insurgents, we call them, or call them resistance or whatever. But you always have this overlap between national, quote-unquote, national resistance and the organized crime. Because people tend to go from one side to another. And I believe we're making a very good progress. One group has split into its original mainstream and a new organization called Hamas of Iraq. The other group we are working with, they have turned against Al Qaeda, and they actually fought Al Qaeda in Diyala. This is apart from the tribal sheikhs in Al Anbar and our effort of tribal work as well in Diyala. But there are serious attempts among these groups, insurgents group, to turn against Al Qaeda. And now, and I can justify what I'm going to say, the overwhelming majority of the Sunni Arab have turned against Al-Qaeda because they cannot see any future in Al-Qaeda. It's only killing and killing and killing. And I think it's not out of despair, but it's out of enlightenment. So, if there is forget everything I've said, and remember one thing. We need some time. This is not a fly-by-night operation. This is not an operation which can be done and come back and clean surgical clinical operation. No, this is a war, a global war. And we are fighting at the forefront on the behalf of the region, on the behalf of the rest of the world. And believe me, if we fail, the whole region will go into flame. And the oil will be disrupted, the oil flow will be disrupted. And the sectarian violence will be spread all over the region. And Europe, mainland Europe, and America, they're not going to be immune from this, from the spillover of the violence, whether it's sectarian violence or terrorists of Al-Qaeda. and Al-Qaeda, according to our intelligence information, Al-Qaeda has decided to make two bases now for it. One is in well, western Pakistan and eastern Afghanistan, to launch operations, their attacks in South Asia and Southeast Asia. While Iraq is the base of Al-Qaeda to the Arab world, to the Middle East, and to Europe. So if we fail, I think failure is not, shouldn't be an option at all. And those who adopt the short precipitous withdrawal or withdrawal or phased even withdrawal, I think they are inviting really for a serious trouble in the whole region. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, we want to thank you. Thank you so much for a great presentation, and I'm sure some friends will want to say hello before you leave if you have them anymore.